Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
The Black Museum.
Its affiliated stations present Escape. Hall of Fantasy. Inner Sanctum Mystery. Murder at midnight. A sealed book presents Suspense. I am the Whistler.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Retro Radio Sunday on Weird Darkness. Each week I bring you a show from the golden age of radio, but still in the genre of Weird Darkness. I'll have stories of the macabre and horror, mysteries and crime, and even some dark science fiction. If you're new here, welcome to the show, and if you're already a member of this weirdo family, please take a moment and invite someone else to listen. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook and Twitter, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up, it's an episode from The Black Museum, a radio crime drama program produced by Harry Allen Towers in London. It was broadcast in Europe on Radio Luxembourg, a commercial radio station, and eventually made its way to the BBC many years later in 1991. The Black Museum was based on real-life cases from the files of Scotland Yard's Black Museum, later renamed the Crime Museum. The actual museum the radio show is based on is a collection of criminal memorabilia kept at New Scotland Yard, headquarters of the Metropolitan Police Service in London, England. Known as the Black Museum until the early 21st century, the museum came into existence at Scotland Yard sometime in 1874. Initially unofficial, it had become an official, albeit private, museum by 1875, with a police inspector and a police constable assigned to official duty there. Not open to the public, it was used as a teaching collection for police recruits and was only ever accessible by those involved in legal matters, royals, and other VIPs. Now sited in the basement of New Scotland Yard, the museum remains closed to the public, but can be visited by officers of the Metropolitan Police and any of the country's police forces by prior appointment. Individual objects have been loaned to exhibitions at other museums, though. In 2019 through 2020, that included objects from Leatherslade Farm in a great train robbery exhibition at the Portal Museum, and a cigarette lighter with a hidden compartment from the Kroger's in a GCHQ exhibition at the Science Museum. Back to the Black Museum radio show. The program was transcribed, which is an old-time radio show term for recorded, in 1951, and it was then rebroadcast in the United States in 1952 on the Mutual Radio Network. More than 500 of the network's stations carried it, which makes it an incredible success, as it matches today's popular coast-to-coast AM program, originally hosted by Art Bell, but back when there were fewer radio stations in existence. Ira Marion was the scriptwriter for the Black Museum, and music for the series was composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. An interesting side note, the same music was used for the opening credits of the 1955 film They Can't Hang Me, starring Terrence Morgan. Orson Welles was both host and narrator of the Black Museum for stories of horror and mystery. The show's opening always began the same way, with Orson Welles introducing himself, the sound of chimes from Big Ben, and then a brief description. Here, in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a woman's shoe, a tiny white box, a quilted robe, are all touched by murder. In 2002, The Black Museum was brought to television as an anthology series and even used the original narration by Orson Welles. The TV adaptation, however, did not capture the popularity of the radio series and only ran for two seasons. Tonight, I present program number 34 of the Black Museum, an episode entitled The Raincoat, which aired in 1952. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the weird darkness.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here, in a grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, there's a warehouse of homicide. A very strange room where everyday objects, a woman's shoe, a tiny white box, a quilted robe, all are touched by murder. You take this raincoat. It's a familiar object, waterproof cloth, rayon lining, collar. You can turn up against stormy weather. Here in London, it's called a Macintosh. But you wouldn't wear this raincoat.
Odd, isn't it, Inspector? The way it was tucked around that poor woman?
And partially burned, as if someone had tried to destroy the evidence.
Well, it is evidence, sir. But against whom?
I'm not sure yet. But this raincoat, Sergeant, this raincoat will hang someone. You can depend on it.
Today, that raincoat can be seen in a very special position in that very curious room in Scotland Yard, which is known as the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Museum, starring Orson Welles.
And here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's museum. It's a museum of murder. Here are the objects of homicide, the weapons, the clues, which one time and another betrayed killers. They've been collected over 100 years. And now here they are, shelf upon shelf, in this dim, echoing room. Here lies death, on these shelves, in these glass cases. Just for instance, in this case, a simple mallet. Just the sort of thing a suburbanite might use in his garage or his shop working at wood carving on a quiet weekend. As a matter of fact, a suburbanite did use this mallet on a quiet weekend, but not for wood carving. Ah, the raincoat. Here we are. Stained, charred, too, around the edges. There isn't anything you'd like to handle for very long, but there's a story attached to it. A story begins in the kind of place you immediately associate with absolute silence. No, not a graveyard. A chess club. It is silent, isn't it? And into this silence of concentration There intruded...
London City Chess Club.
Is Mr. Agard there?
Sorry, sir, I haven't seen him yet. This is the steward of the club. May I take a message? We're expecting him.
I see. My name is Champfer. My address is 46 Edison Mews East. He knows. We've had some contact by way of Agard's insurance business.
Yes, sir. And the message?
I want to see him about a policy. Tell him it's rather urgent. I want him at my house tomorrow evening at 7:30 sharp.
Very well, sir. I'll tell him as soon as he gets in. Mr. Agard, sorry to disturb you, sir.
Just a moment, steward. There. Now, your move. Now, steward.
A most important telephone message for you, sir. Came in about half an hour ago before you came in. Otherwise, I would never have disturbed you. From a Mr. Champfer, sir.
Champfer. Strange name. Oh, yes. Yes, perhaps I do know him. May I have the message, steward?
That was all. That was all until the next evening. A little bit after 7 o'clock on a streetcar, this quiet little insurance salesman, John Agard, said to the conductor of the streetcar...
I beg your pardon. Does this car take me to Edison Mews East? I've never been out there before, you see. I'm not...
Yes, you're all right, mister. Take you about 20 minutes from here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll call it out for you if you like.
Oh, yes. Thank you again. Thank you very much. Oh, I beg your pardon. May I trouble you for the right time, please?
It's, 7:35.
I am right for Edison Mews East, aren't I?
That one block to the car line.
Oh, thank you. I beg your pardon, Constable.
Yes, sir?
I am looking for a Mr. Champfer. In Edison Mews East, I have an appointment. It's insurance. Do you happen to know the gentleman, officer?
I'm afraid not, sir.
Oh, dear, and my date was for 7:30. Is it much past that now?
7:45, sir. Steeple chimes just struck the 3:15.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sorry to have troubled you, officer.
He seemed a worried little man, John Agard, upset over his difficulty in finding Mr. Champfer, and he was still worried, apparently, about an hour later, when his next-door neighbors, Harry and Ethel Benson, saw him coming across the scrap of lawn which separated their houses.
Here's Agard coming over. Funny.
Why is it funny, Harry? They come over very often.
Well, that's just it. Martha isn't with him. Funny.
Such a devoted couple. Martha had a bad cold today. Perhaps John needs something.
Well, no, isn't enough. There he is. Hello, Agard. Spotted you coming across the lawn.
Yes. Good evening. You know, I am sorry to bother you.
No bother at all. Do you need something for Martha's cold?
Oh, you know about that. No, and yes. I suppose the cold made her forget to unbolt the doors when she went to bed.
You mean you can't get into your own house, old man?
That's it. Front and back. I can't seem to open either of them. I don't quite know what to do about it.
It's not like Martha to forget a thing like that. Does she always bolt the door behind you when she's alone?
Oh, at night, yes. There's only the two of us. I do so rarely go out without her, but tonight it was business. If you'd come across with me, I'd appreciate it, sir.
The three of them crossed the lawn to the Agard house. Three ordinary people. An insurance agent, a bank clerk, bank clerk's wife. The wife said...
Let me try the front door, just for luck.
John Agard said...
It won't help her. I've tried several times.
The woman tried it.
That's a bit strange. I could have sworn.
It happens lots of times. The lock gets stuck. It's really open and you think it's locked and it just won't work.
Well, now you're here, won't you stop in for a moment?
What with Martha's cold and all that...
Oh, she'll like to see you. Come in, please.
Well, just for a minute.
Hey, Martha? Martha, dear? The Bensons are with me. Martha!
Oh, my... Oh.
Good Lord. Martha.
She was dead. Completely, horribly dead. One look. No doctor could help. A woman's head was battered in. She lay before the fireplace, her arms and legs twisted awkwardly like some carelessly drop a wooden figure, and there was blood on the hearth, and on the walls too, on the chair, on the rugs. And tucked around the body, as you tuck a blanket around a child, was a raincoat.
Let me go over this once more, Mr. Agar.
Of course, Inspector. If you think it'll help.
Details very often help. You say you left here just before 7, took a trolley to Edison Mews, but you couldn't find the address or the man who'd called you, even asked a constable on the beat. Then you returned home to what you found.
That is correct, sir.
And your wife was alive when you left home.
Oh, of course. That was about 7:15.
The boy who delivers milk says he saw her in the kitchen through the window about that time. The newsboy says he tossed the evening paper at the front door about 6:30, but saw no one. Can you corroborate any of those points?
Oh, I took the paper with me at 7:15. Martha was alive when I left. Who could have done this, Inspector? Who?
We'll find out. We usually do. May I see the cuffs of your trousers, Mr. Agar?
The cuffs of my... Oh, yes. But whatever for?
Thank you. No? No stains of any kind?
Do you really think for one minute that I
we
could have...
We think nothing. Not yet. The raincoat, Mr. Agar, is it yours?
Are there two worn spots at the buttonholes?
There are.
It's none.
When did you see it last?
It was hanging on its usual hook in the hall.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Agar. That's about all for now.
That's about all for now. But not nearly all. The experts were at work. Somewhere, somehow, the tiny thread which would lead to the heart of the tangle would be found. In a quiet office in Scotland Yard, Inspector Mason discussed the experts' reports with Sergeant Crandall.
It couldn't have been robbery. Agar reports nothing missing.
Agar reports a lot of things, including a mysterious telephone call that took him on a wild goose chase.
During which he seems to take good care to leave a clear trail of his own movements. She was seen alive between 6:30 and 6:45. Agar was in the tobacco shop at 7:35. The girl who works there remembers him.
He probably took good care she would.
Beyond a doubt he did that. But he couldn't have battered her to death after 6:45, cleaned up, destroyed whatever he was wearing, and still be in that shop at 7:35.
Or made that trolley car a few minutes after 7.
Exactly.
Which leaves us, Inspector?
With the raincoat.
It's odd, isn't it, Inspector? The way it was tucked around that poor woman.
And partially burned, as if someone tried to destroy the evidence.
Well, it is evidence, sir. But against whom?
I'm not sure yet. But this raincoat, Sergeant, this raincoat will hang someone. You can depend on it.
That was all they had. The raincoat. Inspector Mason thought about it.
It was tucked around her, just as if someone who loved her were taking care of her.
There was a thread. It seemed the only thread. Where did it lead? Where could it lead? Where could any of it lead?
John Agar, you're under arrest, and you'll be later charged with the murder of your wife, Martha. It is my duty to caution you that anything you may say...
Today, that raincoat can be seen in a very special position in that very curious room in Scotland Yard, which is known as the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Thank you.
If you love old-time radio, you'll want to visit our friends at ClassicRadioStore.com, who provide all the shows for me to wear. At ClassicRadioStore.com, you'll find thousands of episodes available in pristine, digitally remastered sound. Every episode they offer at ClassicRadioStore.com has been transferred from the master recordings and digitally remastered for superior sound quality. That's why the episodes that you hear on Weird Darkness sound so clean. And the shows at ClassicRadioStore.com are all uncut, unedited, and are delivered to you as they were originally broadcast, including the classic commercials. You can download great shows that'll chill you and thrill you, such as Suspense, The Whistler, Inner Sanctum, Lights Out, and more. There are mystery and crime shows like Sherlock Holmes, Philip Marlowe, Dragnet, and Sam Spade. They got a great collection of old-time science fiction radio shows like X-1 or Dimension X. Plus, there is a ton of comedy and westerns there too if you want to relive the shows of yesteryear. All the shows are available to instantly digitally download, and the links never expire, so you can order them now and listen to them anytime you'd like. And because you're a listener of Weird Darkness, you can save 20% on any and all radio shows on the website by using the promo code WEIRD at checkout. Just visit ClassicRadioStore.com, select all the radio show packages you want, then at checkout use the promo code WEIRD and save 20% on your whole purchase. That's ClassicRadioStore.com, promo code WEIRD at checkout. Hey Weirdos, we are in the final days of our Overcoming the Darkness fundraiser, and every dollar we receive will be donated to organizations that help people who struggle with depression. Those organizations, of course, being the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, the International Foundation for Research and Education on Depression, and 7-Cups. Brittany gave $100 with an email saying, "My husband is a veteran, and suicide awareness is an issue that is close to our hearts. I pray that you'll surpass your goal this year and every year to come. We did what we could financially to help." And Deborah donated $5 and then emailed me to say, "I don't have much, but I donated $5 to Overcoming the Darkness and I pray that many others will too." Thank you, Deborah. Your $5 is not small. When you have 30 to 50,000 listeners and less than 50 people donate to your fundraiser, you are in a very special and precious minority. I have many others to thank, which I will do next week in the new episodes, but this lets you know that whatever size gift you give, it makes a giant difference, because you're doing something most people don't. You're doing what you can to help someone else who is hurting. You still have time to give during the fundraising campaign. Just go to WeirdDarkness.com and click on Hope in the Darkness to make your donation, and also to find all of these resources that we are supporting. Resources that offer their services free to those who are struggling with depression, anxiety, and thoughts of suicide. Please make your donation today by visiting the Hope in the Darkness page at WeirdDarkness.com.
And now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Well, they charged John Aykert with the murder of his wife, Martha. The evidence seems slight, pretty flimsy, but still, there were strange lapses, contradictions of character, quiet little insurance salesman responds to a call from a possible client, and suddenly he's talkative, almost garrulous. He establishes himself at definite places at definite times with total strangers, all of whom can be checked quite easily by the police. The possible client is non-existent. And then, of course, there was the raincoat. From the very beginning, the prosecutor for the Crown made it clear that a great deal of his case rested on that raincoat.
And if the prisoner did commit this murder for apparently no reason, he deserves the full punishment. Much will be made of the quiet life he led with his wife. Much will be made of the fact that no telltale trace of blood was found on him or his clothing. But I say to you, and we hope to prove this to your satisfaction, that this woman could have been beaten to death by someone wearing only the raincoat, which we will place in evidence. Now, who, ladies and gentlemen of the jury,
could have approached Martha Agard naked, save for that raincoat, except her husband, the prisoner, John Agard. Moreover, as you will see, the police officer...
There was more of the same, much more. Counsel for the Crown was out to make an impression, no doubt about that. But then, so was counsel for the defense.
My colleague has already admitted that no trace of blood was found upon my client, although from the condition of the body and the room, it would seem impossible that the killer could have escaped the touch of it. Then again, there was no time. John Agard could never have committed this crime, performed the necessary ablutions, and been where he was definitely seen between 6:45, when his poor wife was last seen alive by a third party, and 7:05, the moment when my client spoke to the trolley conductor. But far, far more important is the relationship between my client and his poor wife. A relationship of love, of understanding, of the perfect companionship of declining years. For that reason alone, I submit my client could never have committed the crime with which he stands charged today.
So it began. The legal lines of battle were drawn. 12 honest men sat in the jury box and gave their whole attention to the parade of witnesses, to the arguments, to the cross-examinations. Sergeant Crandall gave evidence on the amount of blood and the places where it was found. Defense counsel cross-examined.
It is apparent, Sergeant, that there was an attempt to burn the raincoat, which is now in evidence. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Such an operation would take some time, would it not?
Well, I assume so. I can't say for certain. I've never experimented with a raincoat.
Very well. You saw the scene of the crime before it was cleaned up, did you not?
I did.
From what you saw, would you say it was possible for the killer to escape splashes of blood?
Well, I doubt it.
He would get blood on his legs, his hands, his face, his hair.
I expect so.
Were any such traces found on my client?
Well, none that I know of.
There's been a suggestion made that the murderer took a bath before leaving the premises. Did you see any traces of a bath, a wet towel, indications in the bathtub?
No, sir. Nothing like that.
One more point, Sergeant.
These were the telling points. But the Crown made its own points as well.
Inspector Mason, what was your impression of the defendant when you first questioned him?
I was rather surprised at him. He showed less emotion than I did.
How was this indicated?
We sat in the room where the murder had occurred. Mr. Agard smoked and talked. He held his cat on his knees and stroked it quite calmly. At one point, he casually stepped...
Such points do impress juries. A clever prosecutor. Quite clever. He called the steward of the chess club.
Was Mr. Agard in the club when the telephone call came from this mysterious Mr. Champa?
No, sir. I looked particularly. He was not there.
Did you recognize this Champa's voice?
I'd never heard it before. I haven't heard it since.
Might it have been a disguised voice?
It might. It sounded muffled. Very heavy, sort of.
Thank you. Your witness.
Steward, in your observations of Mr. Agard, have you ever seen him behave as a poor loser?
No, sir, never.
Has he ever expressed violent opinions, to your knowledge?
Mr. Agard violent? He's the quietest man I've ever known.
Did he ever mention his wife to you?
Many times, sir.
On what occasions?
Usually about 9 in the evening. He always worried about leaving her alone too late at night, sir. Oh, very considerate of her he is, was, sir.
Thank you, that's all.
There it was, all they had. An elusive case. An impression, really, more than a case. Very difficult to prove, but just as difficult to defend. For instance, the evidence of Harry Benson, who was with John Agard when the body was discovered.
And in all the years you've been neighbors, what would you say impressed you most about my client's relationship with his wife?
His absolute devotion. Never a quarrel, never a raised voice. They liked the same things. They were perfect for each other.
Your witness.
Mr. Benson, after the discovery, who called the police?
Why, Agard did, come to think of it. My wife was very upset. She was sick over what she'd seen, as a matter of fact. Yes, he was the one who thought of the police. He used the telephone quite calmly.
Quite calmly. Thank you, Mr. Benson.
And naturally, the defense brought John Agard's immediate superior to the stand, the manager of the local branch of the insurance company Agard represented.
This man's testimony was double-edged. On direct examination, he stated,
"We have always had complete faith in Mr. Agard's integrity and character. He carried a large policy on his own life in favor of his wife, as she was not insured. To the best of our knowledge, which is rather complete, Mr. Agard has never been in financial trouble in his life."
On cross-examination, he explained,
"Yes, I live near Edison Mews East. Mr. Agard has been to my house many times. He knows the way very well. I cannot imagine why he asked for directions. I was at the cinema that evening. My neighbor recognized Mr. Agard when he came to the door of my house. Unfortunately, I was not at home."
When John Agard's turn came to take the witness stand, there was little left for him to say.
"I did not kill her. I had no reason to. I loved her."
Opposing counsel summed up. The judge made his charge to the jury.
"Again and again, you have heard the importance of the time element in this case. Could this man, or any man, have committed this crime, removed all traces of it from his person, dressed and been at a trolley car line 20 minutes from his house, in the time between the moment the milk boy saw the victim alive and the moment the conductor saw the defendant on the trolley car? More, there is no evidence to connect the defendant directly with the crime. The case is entirely circumstantial. No motive has been established. I could only..."
They listened. The 12 honest men in the jury box. They retired and they debated. What went on in that jury room is sealed in silence under the honored tradition of the law. Anyway, 40 minutes elapsed. Then the jury re-entered the courtroom. The clerk asked the usual question. "Are you agreed upon a verdict?"
"We are."
"Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty?"
"Guilty."
"Prisoner at the bar, have you anything to say why you should not die according to the law?"
"I am not guilty. I have nothing else to say."
"You are looking well, John."
"They treat me well. I had a shock yesterday. The governor of the prison came here. He said 8 o'clock in the morning, Monday the 16th.
"Don't worry, John. It will be put over."
"The appeal?"
"It's being studied. The court won't rule for another month at least. They'll grant a stay of execution."
"A month. Another month."
A month. An extra week after that. Time went on, endlessly, it seemed, to John Agard, waiting in his cell in Walton Prison. And at long last, they gave him his own clothes and took him before 3 judges of the Court of the Criminal Appeal. Handcuffed, he stood there between the bailiff and his own counsel. The voice of the judge seemed very far away.
"There is indeed a reasonable doubt in this case. We believe there is eminent difficulty and doubt. The case against the appellant was not proved with the certainty necessary to a verdict of guilty. This appeal will be allowed. The prisoner will go free."
Yes, he went free. But the raincoat, that famous raincoat, can still be found today in its place of very particular honor in that curious room known as the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. We'll be right back. Now here in person is Orson Welles.
So, Inspector Mason was wrong, wasn't he? The raincoat didn't hang anybody after all. John Agard went free, and for the first time in the history of English law, a conviction for murder was set aside for reasonable doubt. Now, what happened to John Agard? He lived out his life. Just 2 years after his release, he died. Some say of loneliness in Liverpool, a broken, weary old man. I've seen his grave in Liverpool. And I've seen the raincoat. That famous, enigmatic raincoat. In its place of particular honor. In that strange room in Scotland Yard. Known as the Black Museum. Now, till we meet again in the same place for another story of the same kind, I remain as always obedient for yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attractions. The program is written by Ara Marion, with original music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Thanks for listening to this week's Retro Radio episode of Weird Darkness. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves old-time radio. And a huge thanks to our friends at ClassicRadioStore.com for generously providing the old-time radio shows you hear on Weird Darkness Retro Radio Sunday. Remember, you can save 20% on all of the ClassicRadioStore.com shows by using the promo code WEIRD at checkout. The rest of the week, I narrate new stories of the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, and mysteries. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so. I upload episodes 7 days a week. You can email me anytime with your questions or comments at darren@weirddarkness.com. Darren is D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and the show's Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at weirddarkness.com. Also on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell of your own, click on Tell Your Story or call the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.